everybody, and welcome to Adjusted. I'm your host, Greg Hamlin, coming at you from beautiful Birmingham, Alabama, where the skies are so blue, and Berkeley Industrial Comp, a WR Berkeley company. And I wanted to introduce and share this special rebroadcast. This one is especially important to me. I've spent the majority of my career in Appalachia, where the opioid crisis started that we dealt with through the last 20 years or so. And took too many lives. So one of the things that we've constantly been focusing on in the workers' comp space is how do we help our injured workers deal with pain and at the same time recover without causing problems that will lead to long-term addiction. And so I had the opportunity to spend some time with Dr. Jeffrey Hazelwood out of Tennessee. And I worked with Dr. Hazelwood in my prior life across a couple different companies. And he always did an excellent job helping injured workers to deal with their pain in ways that may not involve opioids. So I want to share this episode with you and hope you enjoyed as much as I did recording it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Adjusted. I'm your host, Greg Hamlin, coming at you from Berkeley Industrial Comp in Sweet Home, Alabama. And with me is my co-host,
Claire Musselman, coming to you from beautiful and sunny Des Moines, Iowa.
We are so excited to have with us a special guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Hazelwood from Lebanon, Tennessee. And we're going to be discussing today alternatives to opioids and some of the challenges that our countries face with the opioid crisis. So we're excited to have you with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hazelwood.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. I appreciate the invitation.
All right, so Dr. Hazelwood, inquiring minds want to know, how on earth did you get into the industry?
Good question. First of all, the industry of physical medicine and rehab, I guess, but especially work comp. So first of all, a PM&R physician, hopefully everybody knows now what that is. When I started in 1996, I had to get out and explain exactly what I was, but it's a smaller specialty where we deal with musculoskeletal and neurological cases, many times injuries. So I started out actually in 1996. I did my residency at the University of Alabama, Birmingham in PM&R. And then I moved to Lebanon in 96 and with intent of just doing inpatient rehabilitation. So I ran a rehab unit, medical director of a rehab unit, but I had a little small side practice with outpatient physical medicine and rehab treatment. I did the rehab unit for 14 years and gradually grew the outpatient practice and pretty early on really got interested in workers' comp. One of my last rotations at Birmingham was at the workplace, it was called, and really got some good training on workers' compensation. And back then, residents really didn't get that much training in work comp. So I pretty much learned on the fly as I went through practice and learned the hard way of what not and what to do. But over the years, I've been practicing now about 25 years, and 80% of my practice now is just work comp. So I gradually have built an interest. And as I always say in my presentations, this quote I have, working hard for something we don't care about is called stress. Working hard for something we love is called passion. And I always explain, gosh, to do workers' compensation, and especially treating opioids in these chronic cases and trying to get these people off of opioids, one has to have passion or you just can't do it. And you guys have passion for what you do. But workers' comp is tough. And that's why a lot of doctors, I think, don't want to do it or afraid to do it. But once you build the skills and develop the skills, I think it's such a challenging and really rewarding subspecialty. And it's almost a subspecialty in itself, understanding how to do workers' compensation correctly. So long answer, but I started inpatient and now outpatient and now primarily workers' comp and love what I do. And have the passion for it, thankfully, still.
Okay, so I love that because you talk about the passion and the purpose, and that is exactly what gets Greg and I all fired up. And it's exactly why we're in workers' compensation too. So what keeps you staying here? Because that's kind of one of the things, like we all joke about getting into the industry isn't necessarily something that when I was in fifth grade or fourth grade or third grade that I would have wanted to assume that I would be doing with my life. But I've loved every minute of being here and I have no intention of leaving. So for you and from your standpoint, especially in your specialty, what keeps you in the workers' compensation space?
Yeah, I think continually learning and fine-tuning the trade, so to speak. And I've gotten really into the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of education, trying to go out. I was work close with the Bureau of Workers' Compensation of Tennessee. So we go out and do a lot of presentations and education of physicians, case managers, insurance adjusters, attorneys, even judges sometimes. And I think in Tennessee, since about 2014, a lot of the laws have changed where now in every single case, we have to address causation right off the bat. And so I've really gotten into studying the science of causation, the methodology of understanding causally related medicine. I go to a lot of the national conferences. The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons has a yearly conference, 3-day conference on causation. So learning that over the last several years and learning it well has been a new energizer to me. I also have an expertise in impairment ratings. I think in Alabama, you guys use the 4th edition. Still the red book, if I'm not mistaken. Tennessee, we're on the 6th edition. I see a lot of Kentucky cases on the 5th edition. So gosh, you have to really study and keep abreast of all the different nuances in the edition guideline. And then I think now I'm 80% still treating physician. I do a lot of medical legal record reviews and IMAs, but I'm 80% treating physician. And it's every day a challenge to try to take good care of the patients. And I think over the last 5 years, I've really devoted myself to trying to practice evidence-based medicine approach. And in Tennessee, we're under the official disability guidelines where we're encouraged to use evidence-based medicine. And now I'm on a mission, and I'll give you a good story later if you want, about I almost burned out about 5 years ago, but then got kind of a new energy and getting on a mission to say, I'm going to start getting my patients off of narcotics and really working hard to implement the approach needed to try to wean these legacy cases off of narcotics, but understanding their alternative approaches. And we're going to talk about that, I think, later.
That's fantastic, Dr. Hazel. You know, I lived in Kentucky a few years back, so neighbor state of yours. And when we look at the opioid crisis, they always say the epicenter, it was the Appalachia area. And of course, since then, it's spread to all parts of the country. And I think every community has had a loved one or a friend or a family member that struggled with opioid addiction. And I think we're finally reaching a point now where people are talking about it, where for a long time it was kind of the quiet story. And being in workers' comp, of course, we see so many injured workers who deal with pain. So this is something that comes up a lot. I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about some of the challenges you've seen being in the epicenter of the opioid crisis and then managing that and seeing maybe what's happened from the 90s when you arrived in Tennessee to today when it comes to pain and opioids.
Right. I think, you know, the pendulum has swung several times since I've been in practice. When I was in school, we really didn't prescribe opioids that much. And then I guess the late 90s, early 2000s, when OxyContin came out, and all of the Opana extended releases. And there was a big boom. And the hospitals, they mandated that you've got to take care of patients' pain. So you're looking at the visual analog scale scores. And if they were 7, 8, 9 out of 10 pain, you know, it was considered inhumane not to treat them for their pain. And even stories that a doctor could get sued if you didn't appropriately use narcotics to get the pain under control. But then you know what happened where the crisis hit and all of the deaths started occurring and the pendulum has swung way back now the other direction. And all so many of the states, Tennessee especially, may be the most aggressive state in the nation, rules and regulations on appropriate prescribing. I'm on the opioid committee for the state where we put out opioid guidelines for physicians. And so many of these patients were treating with primary care physicians, not pain specialists. So primary care physicians who were trying to take care of their folks, you know, were prescribing outrageous amounts of narcotics. And so we really tried to get out and educate and understand the dangers of narcotics. And I think it, you know, it comes down to everything we do in medicine is it gets as simple as saying what are the pluses and what are the minuses, what are the benefits, what are the risks of everything we do, whether it's medication management, whether it's ordering a fusion or a surgeon performing a fusion, whether it's epidurals, whether it's therapy. You're always looking at the pluses and the minuses. And so there's so many minuses of opioids, but I don't believe in saying nobody deserves them. I believe in the doctor going through the process of figuring out which ones deserve it and which ones do not. And the older I get, the more conservative I get. And I'm convinced that about 10% of people need to be on opioids. And if you look at all the risk, I'd say about 90% have risks that outweigh benefit. And so many of my patients that I've been taking care of for 20 years, I inherit a lot of cases where they're already on them for years. We call them the legacy cases. And those are so hard to get off of the narcotics when they've been on them forever. But so many of my patients, there's no addiction there, but they do have a psychological dependency. But they do not misuse. They do not abuse. They take it just like I say, and I preach them a sermon if they don't. They know they've got to do it by the book. But then when I try to get them off of them, they're so psychologically dependent and afraid that I'm going to hurt and I can't get off of them. That's not addiction. That's not the disease of addiction, but it's a physical and psychological dependency. So it takes a heck of a lot of time and effort to fight through that and explain the dangers and educate and counsel. And the biggest problem I see is polypharmacy, this mixture of drugs. It's not just the dose of narcotic that kills people. It's the mixture with alcohol, with marijuana, with benzodiazepines, with sleeping pills, with muscle relaxers, and these cocktails that they come to us on. Everything has been written by doctors. They're taking it just like the doctor said take, but nobody has taken the time to look at the combination and the risk of combination. You get somebody with apnea, you get somebody with asthma, you get somebody with heart failure, and you add all this stuff on top of it, and then you throw in a little Jack Daniels every once in a while on top of that. Man, you're talking about trouble. And it's my job, I see, to sit down and explain the risk. The benefits are two. I'm feeling better, my pain level is better, and hopefully a few, they say their function is better. But the risks are a mile long. You know, dependency, addiction, opioid hyperalgesia that I think we're going to talk about in a little bit. Tolerance, that's one of the biggest problems I see. Is they, the longer they take them, they build up an immunity or resistance. And then they say, I want more. That's not addiction. They build up a tolerance. So endocrine disorders, opioid-induced mood disorder, depression driven by the drugs, not from pain, from the drugs. So the doctor has got to take the time to sit down and weed through all of that and assess benefit versus risk and then provide other options of treatment. But you see how gut-wrenching that can be. And people get mad. They get upset. They get angry. I mean, it's awful. But if you devote yourself to doing it the right way, you're willing to go through that. And then you have some success stories that I can talk about later that keep you going. And it keeps you from burning out. And it makes you feel like, gosh, I am a doctor. I'm not just a pill writer. So that's the key. But you can sure burn out if you're not careful.
So I appreciate you sharing all of that. So my mom is part of this. I don't want to call it a crisis, and I don't want to call it an epidemic. I don't want to call it any of that. So, because these are real people, they're real family members. Where we sit right now is where we're at. Like, I don't, so when we look at this, you just talked a lot about like the psychological need, and it is that way. Like, it's been very challenging. So my mom had a back surgery back in 2005, started with the OxyContin. You know how this, like, it just keeps going. But I mean, to hear the it's not an addiction. I agree with you. It's very psychological, because the way that she would say, well, I need X med. And I would say, well, mom, that's not what that medication is for. And she's like, don't argue with me. I need that. So I agree. I don't believe it's an addiction from being like a child of watching this transpire. But I liked how you talk about, like, it becomes this psychological, I don't know what if I want to, because it's not necessarily a dependency, but it almost is.
It's a crutch. I think it's a crutch.
Yeah, it's a crutch, because a lot of this stuff I feel, and again, this is very personal to me because I watched my mom kind of really destroy a lot of relationships as a result of this. And so when we look at the psychological components that go into this, why does that make this so challenging? Because, and I can be very specific to my mother because she's never going to listen to this podcast either, but she was running 3 different yoga studios, had a fantastic yoga Pilates practice, has a back surgery, and then suddenly is the most crippled individual on the face of the earth. And I firmly believe it didn't have to do with the surgery and the meds, but it is the psychological, the psychosocial issues that really, it's why I got really deep into this industry and really why I focus so much of my time on psychosocial issues, because that's where I feel like a lot of this stuff, if we put the right focus on the right areas at the beginning of work comp, a lot of this stuff doesn't manifest to what it is. We just weren't that well educated back then on knowing what psychosocial issues were and how they would manifest when a failed back surgery occurs, or we end up going down an opioid route. So I'm curious, from your standpoint, what are some of the psychological, the psychosocial issues that you've seen and how they impact patients' pain? And I'm not going to say that it's just for me and for my childhood issues with my mother now, but I'm fascinated by this because it's one of the reasons that I'm so drawn to this topic of what happened. And I know that a lot of times the industry throws so much blame on, well, you know, it was an opioid crisis. I don't necessarily think that's what it really was. I think we failed to understand mental health in a variety of ways, but I would love your medical opinion of this.
Right. Well, I think number one, make sure the diagnosis is correct. And so many of these people, I think, get unnecessary surgery because the surgeons sometimes operate based on the picture they're seeing, not the patient. So treat the disease, not the illness, we try to teach. So illness is the whole manifestation of pain. So sometimes that degenerative disc disease is not the pain generator. They hurt because they've got psychosocial issues around them. They have no support system, many patients. We look at childhood adverse events, where so many of these patients that you look back on with chronic pain have had sexual abuse growing up, physical abuse. I'm sure your mom wasn't that way, but you'd be shocked how many people were, where growing up, they had poor support systems and their coping skills are non-existent. So when a surgeon comes in there quickly and he's already made his or her mind up before they walk in the room that I'm operating based on the picture, without listening to the patient, talking to the patient, examining the patient, and making sure that that pain generator truly matches up with what's seen on the picture, because if you don't operate on the right thing, they're going to get worse. And now we believe in assessing psychological profiles before we do a lot of things. So when you order a spinal cord stimulator, most insurance mandate a screening psychologically. Really need to do that before you have a fusion surgery. You need to do that before you start narcotics. You need to, that's part of addressing the benefits and the risk. But there's so much depression and anxiety, and these drugs make those things worse. They're downers. It's not just the pain depressing the people, it's the drugs. They're living in a fog and they don't even know it. These drugs are demotivators. They actually take your spirit away, I believe, and take your drive away to live life. It's incredible. So when I see patients that think they're okay, but they're miserable when they admit it, you get them off the narcotics, and all of a sudden they've got a new vision. They wake back up and say, my God, I didn't even know I was that way. But the doctor has got to realize there are other causes of pain besides what just shows up on an MRI. And that's where your psychological issues come in. Your support. I feel like so many of my patients, I'm writing a narcotic not for physical pain. I'm writing for psychological pain. And they're willing to just feel good for a few minutes to escape their world so many times. And that Norco or hydrocodone or OxyContin gives them that quick release. But then it ends up biting them in their behind down the road. And so many patients, not everybody, but so many patients. So I think bottom line is a psychological evaluation, cognitive behavioral therapy is absolutely critical in so many of these patients to teach, to not, fear avoidance is one of the worst things. They think if I'm going to do something, I'm going to hurt myself. No, you're hurting yourself by not doing something. Catastrophizing. Woe is me. My God, my world is terrible. I'm negative, negative, negative. So that's where a psychologist can retrain thinking and spin it more positive. Exercise is critical. Get off your behind. Work on weight loss. Work on a diet. Work on an anti-inflammatory approach. Get wean off these narcotics gradually. Exercise. Quit smoking. You know, all of these basic things changes a person's whole feeling. And then you get the ball rolling. I'm a skinny guy, but I love to eat. If I let myself go, I'd weigh 400 pounds. I love to eat. But I have to practice this, and I have to get on a roll. So if I'm gain some weight, I've got to lose it. I say, I can't do it. Lord, have mercy. But let me just start with the first week. And then when you start losing, you get on a roll. And then you feel guilty if you don't keep on that diet. It's the same thing with drugs. You got to get them started, get a momentum going. Add other things that can kick in, alternative medicine we can talk about, and then they start getting fired up. They start getting proud of themselves. Then you brag on them. You encourage them. And sometimes you need a psychologist to help you with that. So you see it's a process, but that psychosocial background and that psychological part of chronic pain is huge, and not enough doctors are addressing that.
I feel like you just completely helped me understand so much in such a short amount of time. Oh, thank you for that. I just thank you from the bottom of my heart, because a lot of that makes sense. And I feel like there were so many holidays or whatnot where I would just be like, Mom, you do not understand. Like, this is what's happening to you, but it's not, it can't be your daughter that comes and tells you this. It has to be the physician that is meeting with her.
That it starts with the doctor. It starts and they're overworked. They're pushing to pay the overhead, the reimbursement. It's not going to cover all of this carrying on and counseling and coaching. And so they don't do it. But as I've gotten older and I cut back a little bit in my practice and I don't have to worry as much about the over as I used to, I'm on a new mission. And I think that's the right thing to do. But not enough people are doing it. I think insurance companies need to look at more reimbursement for that kind of approach and stop these dadgum injection after injection with these steroids, these 200 epidurals, and throwing these stimulators in their spine and nobody attending to the problem at hand. The pain generators are not addressed when it's centralized pain. The longer you have pain, it becomes centralized and it's not that disc anymore. Your brain is reading pain. And unless you decentralize that, you're never going to be any better. So it takes a whole different approach. But I think it's starting to happen. And I think the narcotic crisis has forced the doctors and practitioners, if nothing else, by laws, to stop this craziness and quit medicalizing patients. I love the word medicalization. We as doctors have destroyed these people. So maybe we need to admit we've messed up. But do you know how hard it is for a doctor to admit he or she is wrong? We're arrogant people. We think we know everything. But we've got to change our mindset. I really believe that. But I think it's starting to happen more and more.
Dr. Hazelwood, you're one of my favorite people. I love hearing you talk about this topic because I know how passionate you are about it, and means a lot to me because it's something I've seen so many people struggle with. And one of the things that I've heard, and I didn't even know this was a thing, was opioid-induced hyperalgesia. I probably didn't even say that right because I don't have a doctor in front of my name like you do. But I'd love for you to talk more about that because I'm not sure everybody's even familiar with what that is and how that works.
Yeah, there's some doctors that think it's controversial, but I don't. But basically, it means I explain to my patients like throwing gas on a fire. So acute pain many times responds to narcotics, okay? You break a bone, you tear a muscle, you have a root canal. Your narcotic is going to help that pain usually. it's a different ball game with chronic pain. The brain remodels. The brain is a complicated organ, as you know. So this pain center in the brain, the thalamus and all of these other areas, can get hypersensitized by these narcotics in so many patients. Not everybody, but a lot of patients. So the longer one takes narcotic, the worse the pain gets. So it's crazy. You know, people used to think, God, the more I take of a OxyContin, the better my pain should be. Well, what can happen is it actually makes the pain worse. And opioid hyperalgesia is a phenomenon that's been supported by a lot of research literature that does occur in some of these patients. And on exam, sometimes we'll see hypersensitivity to touch of the skin, what we call allodynia. So like you've got a bad sunburn, you barely touch it and it's painful. Opioid hyperalgesic patients many times have that sensitivity. Fibromyalgia, you know, a central pain syndrome, phantom pain. That pain is not in the leg that was gone. The leg's gone. They've amputated, but the brain is reading the pain. The same happens with fibromyalgia. The problem's not in the muscle, it's in the brain reading pain. Complex regional pain syndrome, which is overdiagnosed, but there are a few cases there. It's a central phenomenon. So the brain, part of the pain feeling is big time brain. So when you, if you turn into opioid hyperalgesia, the more you ride, the worse the pain gets. So how do you know if that's happening? Then you start weaning down and the pain starts getting better. Okay. So, and many, I've got so many cases, unbelievable cases where I've got them completely off the narcotics using other things. And they come in and say, I am shocked. Either my pain is no worse or I'm actually better. I mean, it's incredible when you hear that. And I said, I told you that. I've been trying to tell you for 3 years. And they say, I finally listened to you. And dadgummit, you were right. That's what keeps you going when you see a case like that. But it takes an act of God to get them off these drugs. So you've got to do it the right way. So I educate and counsel and preach like I'm doing right now first. And you've got to build their trust. And work comp, they come in angry. They come in afraid. They're seeing this Hazelwood guy in Lebanon. Some attorney sent me here 2 hours. Who are they trying to take me down? So I've got to build that rapport initially and gain their confidence that I'm trying to take care of them. And then you start educating. And I'll bring out graphs and statistics and all of this stuff and show them the research. I'll show them the picture out of Indiana or Ohio of that heroin overdose. And when I give talks, I show the picture, but it's a picture of somebody pulled off on the side of the road where the husband's unconscious, the wife's unconscious. They're slumped over their chair, their seats, and there's a blonde-haired kid in the back seat, 3 years old, smiling when the police come up to the car. Both of the parents, heroin overdoses. The woman started going out first. The husband tried to get her to the ER. Before he got there, he was out. And that's the most unbelievable picture, with both of them slumped over from overdose and the kid in the back seat smiling. So you show that. I show that to my parents. I've got it on my phone. I show them the picture. And I say, this is what can happen. You don't want that to happen, right? So you show them that stuff. Show them the mortality risk curves. The higher you go in narcotic, the curve goes up, where your death rate goes sky high. You had benzos on top of it, sleeping pills, it goes even higher. So good folks, and most of them are, will listen, but the doctor's got to present that. And then you start working on the drugs. You slowly, not quickly, like utilization review tries to get you to do sometimes. You got to slowly chip away at it and knock off the sleeping pill first, or bring down the benzodiazepine, or get a psychiatrist to say that absolutely necessary they have that Xanax, which most of them know. And then get them off the muscle relaxers and start weaning slowly the narcotic. And realize you're going to have flare-ups at times. That's okay. Don't panic. We're going to get through it. Throw a Metrol dose back or give them a Toradol shot or something to get them through the hump. And then slowly work on it. But then start adding the stuff, alternatives. So good physical therapy. Not some Joe Blow sitting in the corner watching TV and they've got 25 people on bikes. I'm talking about somebody getting their hands on. That's the beauty of chiropractic philosophy, hands-on treatment, but good manual therapists working out the soft tissue stuff. And then exercise is important, aerobic exercise, getting the heart rate up, losing weight, but then adding other things on. Some Balta is a great medicine that's an antidepressant, but works on pain. It works on anxiety. It can kill three birds with one stone. It works on nerve pain. It works on mechanical back pain. Your Neurontins and Lyricas within reason, if they have true nerve pain. They're scheduled drugs, but they're not narcotics. Very low risk for addiction. Not the polypharmacy, but using them instead, slowly but surely. Then getting into other options. Cognitive behavioral therapy, we've talked about a little bit. Absolutely critical in some of these patients. 12 visits of therapy per ODG guidelines to work them through this. Counseling, coping issues, deregulating, turning the knob down on the pain, turning the volume knob down, getting it de-escalated as we work on this other stuff. Acupuncture. Unbelievable. And some people, it works. It's research proven. Official Elizabeth Guidelines recommends it. Try 4 visits. I've got about a 15% chance it's going to work, but they deserve that shot at it. ODG recommends it. UR approves it. H-Wave unit is the device that saved me over the last 3 years. It's a new electrical modality, been around 40 years, different from a TENS unit. You put pads on the area of pain. ODG recommends it because it's research proven. I've used it in 350 work comp patients. So far, 180 have had tremendous success. And I've gotten people off narcotics with the use of H-Wave. Tom Brady uses it. Kobe Bryant used it. Joe Montana used it. It's been around 40 years. But now we've got it in work comp. We've got it in the VA population. Private insurance won't pay for it yet. It has been a lifesaver. It doesn't work on everybody, but it can work as an adjunctive treatment, and then I get them off the drug. So you go through this process. You know, yoga in some people works. CBD oil in some people works. If it doesn't have too much THC, it's got to be less than 0.3% or it lights up on a drug screen. It's got too much THC. But it's legal over the counter, not medical marijuana, CBD. So there's all of these different things that we can throw in there. And injection sometimes. It's appropriate to use injections sometimes, but not abuse them. What's the worst thing about 500 epidural? Weight gain. I mean, the steroid, they just gain massive weight on all these injections. Is that good for back pain? Terrible. The doctor's making a fortune, but the patient's getting worse and worse, much less diabetes risk, osteoporosis, pituitary gland problem. I talked to them about it. Do you think the doctor's doing the injections explain this? No, that's the problem. You got to take more time and educate, counsel, and give them hope. And a good patient gives you the chance. But it's not easy. It's hard. But I think that's the right thing to do. And I think more of us need to do that. So I don't know what your initial question was, but I'm down off on the table.
That conversation.
Well, that's the way I talk to my patients. And okay. It's shocking how many good folks are looking for answers. And they're so frustrated. These pain clinics, you know, the persona of a pain clinic is awful. So it's, you've got to, but you don't win every time. I mean, there's no way. Otherwise, I'd have 500 million people. I wouldn't have time to do that. But it does work on some people. But you pick the ones, you know which ones have got a chance, and you give them the chance, and then you fight for them and work comp. Because utilization review is tough. We need it. It's important. But it can be tough. And you've got to understand there are outliers on some of these cases. But alternative treatment, I'm a big believer, is the future. And getting them off the drugs is the key. But I've got to have sense enough to know when somebody needs the narcotic. So you look at quality of life and function. If they're sitting in the chair piled up all day in the bed or the chair and they say, I'm 8 out of 10 pain and I'm doing fine, does that sound fine to you? Would you want to live your life like that?
No.
I wouldn't want to live my life like that. But they think they're okay. But that's where you got to break through that.
So when
you see how fascinating it is if you do it the right way, it's incredible.
So when do you, like you said, there are some instances where opioids can help. I think in the beginning you said something like maybe 90% of the time it's not appropriate, but there are those times when it can be a tool in the toolbox. So maybe talk to us about what some of those times are, or when you've noticed, you know, in this case, it actually makes some sense based on what I'm seeing.
Right. I think you look at function. I try to not just, you know, so many pain specialists say, are you independent of your ADLs? You know, I venture to say if somebody's taking morphine 200 milligrams a day, they're going to dress and bathe themselves. You can't just go by that. So I give functional questionnaires. So you've got your pain disability questionnaire that looks at back pain ratings, but it asks, you know, are you able to go to the grocery? Are you able to dress yourself? Are you able to cook your dinner? Are you able to go to church? You look at those functional questionnaires. There's a brief pain inventory questionnaire that asks enjoyment of life, sleep issues. So I want some kind of measure functionally that I've made improvement. So the key is not just say we're going to start narcotics if I'm seeing them brand new and we've got them forever. I'm going to give it a 30-day trial and we're going to see, is it worth it? Now, first of all, I got to make sure they're not a danger. If they're at NIC and on CPAP at night and weigh 300 pounds and diabetic and taking Valium and a bunch of muscle and sleeping pills and Ambien and all, no, I don't even go down that road. It's too risky. But there are people that are not on polypharmacy. There are people, you look at the opioid risk tool, you assess their addiction risk. Do they have a history of addiction? Do they have a family history of addiction? 40% of addiction, I think, is genetic. Do they have a history of sexual abuse growing up? Are they between the ages of 15 and 45? That's high risk for addiction. Do they have bipolar? Do they have schizophrenia? Do they have depression? Those increase risk factors. So you look for your addiction risk. That doesn't mean if it's high, you don't write them, but it's kind of a red flag. So you got to put all of this stuff together. Drug screens, first visit. You know, if they're lighting up on cocaine, do you think I'm going to write that narcotic? You know, if they have marijuana, I'll give it to them one time, but I'll preach them a sermon and say it's illegal. You know, you can argue whether that's appropriate or not, but in Tennessee, it's illegal. So I'm giving you one more chance, but no more weed. You got to decide, do you want your marijuana or do you want your Norco? But the key is function. Give them a trial, and especially if they're working. I got a lot of patients that say, Dr. Hazelwood, I can't work my job unless I have those two hydrocodone a day. Shame on me if I don't write that, if their benefits outweigh their risk. And they show me that they're using it to function and live life. But so many of these patients are running 7 to 8 out of 10 pain, loaded up, on disability, sitting in a chair all day, sleeping in a bed all day. That's not good. The risk outweigh the benefit. And I swear to goodness, 90% of my patients are that way. But you separate it out in work comp. You got your legacy cases. You've got your new injuries. So every single new injury that comes into me today, I hardly ever initiate narcotics. Because once you start the process, look out. And in Tennessee, there's big laws on how long you can write narcotic acutely after no surgery, after minimal surgery, after major surgery, 20-day max, 3 days if there's no surgery. We got laws, which I think are a good thing. But on the legacy cases, it's not fair to just yank the rug out and pull them completely off their drugs if they've been on for 20 years. That's inhumane. But you can slowly taper down to get them off the dangerous stuff and down at 40 milligrams or less of morphine equivalent is our goal. And then sometimes that's the best you can do. And the horse is out of the barn, and that's the best I can do on those legacy cases. But I think don't start the process. And for the last 2 years, I have not initiated narcotics at the beginning on my patient, and we've done just fine. I've got a few that cuss me out, walk out, but mostly we've done just fine. So it can be done, but you got to explain that stuff. But I think one good thing is the new laws and all this media blitz is helping. Because patients now are actually afraid. They'll come to me and say, I'm scared to come to you as a pain specialist. So I'm scared to get on that stuff. And they equate pain management with drugs. That's what's unfortunate. There are other ways to treat pain besides narcotics.
I really appreciate you talking about that. I, you know, haven't met with you before and heard you speak before. I know some of the time you're able to share some of the success stories, and obviously we want to be careful with people's privacy on that, and I know you know that, but if there is anything that we can share, maybe in generality or that you feel comfortable sharing, where you could talk a little bit about somebody's journey off pain meds and how that works and how you get them through that. And because I know you've had those successes, that's one of the reasons I really think you're a leader in this, this change, is because you've been able to walk some people through this. So if you don't mind, I'd love to hear some of that.
Yeah, sure. One thing I'll start out with, you know, I told you I was about to burn out about 5 years ago. And I've just, you know, you get tired of this mess, as you can hear, it just wears you down. And I started thinking, what do I do as a doctor? I'm just a pill pusher. That's all I do. And it gets, I'm not a neurosurgeon. I'm not saving lives. I'm not operating on bones and getting people walking again. What the heck do I do? So about that time, a lady wrote an article in the Tennessee in the national newspaper, and she was pissed, to excuse my language. Her husband had committed suicide just recently, and it was because of the new laws in Tennessee about the narcotic crisis and doctors get this stuff under control. So her pain clinic had basically just stopped the narcotics on this guy that had had true pain. I think he'd had 3 or 4 back surgeries and they had him on narcotics, but just basically pulled the rug out from under him without offering anything else. He committed suicide because he was so much in pain and I think so afraid of his future. I think it's more of a fear factor than it was the pain. And this lady, bless her, was passionately writing an editorial to the paper about how dare the state of Tennessee do this to my husband. You killed him with your laws. And I said, you got to be kidding. She said, there's no hope for anybody anymore in pain management because of these laws. And I got fired up and wrote a response back and then said, I know you're going through grief and I understand what you're saying, but the problem is there is hope. There are other alternatives. Just because you take away narcotics doesn't mean there's no hope. And then I went into this epistle like I've done about the different things that can be done. And so then I got fired back up saying, gosh, I am a doctor. If I do that stuff, you can save lives, right? So that got me energized. It got me more into this. I tell my patients I'm Methodist, but I can preach a Baptist sermon. And I just go on and on and on. But I'm telling you, it's worth it. And you feel like you're doing something good, right? So I've had so many cases where I use the ability to slowly wean off and add the acupuncture, add the psychology, add the H-wave, add the good exercise, add the good physical therapy, and slowly but surely get them off. And one little stupid thing I do is that I feel like we had to reward these people, okay? It's a hard deal trying to come off this stuff. So my dog, I got a beagle dog. Maybe I gave this in the talk I gave you all the way back, but I'll do it again. A beagle dog. And when she has to go poop, we've got a cowbell hanging from the door and going to the backyard. She reaches up and hits the bell when she has to go poop. And I said, my God, that's what I need to do. I need to ring the bell when I've got a patient who does what I've just said go through. And so we started ringing the bell in the office, a cowbell, when a patient did this. And they just went crazy. They love it. But my point is, you got to reward these people. You got to brag on them. You got to encourage them. And you got to say you did it. It's like losing a lot of weight when you're overweight and you did it. But celebrate it. So it's a momentum that you build up. But I've got several cases. I've gotten off Duragesic and off OxyContin and all of this stuff. And they come back and say, my gosh, I feel like I'm a new person. Had one lady one time that said, I've got my personality back. My family said, your personality is back. Is that not an incredible statement? That Duragesic took away her spirit and personality. It can do that. So I got one guy that was doubled. He had 10 back surgeries, came in the office, and I'm not kidding. He walked at a 90-degree angle, never looked up. My nurses went wild saying, this guy's got to be full of you-know-what. This is crazy. But that man was entrenched in his 90-degree bent forward posture. He had been in a pain clinic. They'd had him loaded sky-high narcotic. He almost died of overdose. He took it like they said, but built up the stuff and almost died. He was in ICU and lived through it, fortunately. And he ran as far as he could from that pain specialist and said, I want another one. So he came to me, and he was on like 40 milligrams morphine equivalent. And we slowly but surely worked him through all this stuff. And then the H-wave unit came out about 3 or 4 years ago, and we tried that. And now he's off narcotic, and believe it or not, he's walking straight up. He's somehow gotten rid of his 90-degree angle. And the last visit I saw him, he said, I want you to know I drove to the office today without my wife. I've not done that in 10 years. So functionally, he was better. He's off narcotic and said, I want you to know I've extended my cane. Instead of on this slot, it's on this slot. So he'd been able to elongate it because he didn't have to walk bent over anymore. So we're going screaming and hollering and hugging and crying and ringing the bell and going crazy. But that's a beautiful example of functional improvement. And that guy would have died had he continued on his narcotics. The other thing that I hadn't talked much about is good physical therapy. So I had this lady that was thrown up on the hood of a car. She came to me with groin pain. She was having hip and groin pain. Her MRI had shown an acetabular tear, a labral tear, in the cartilage of the hip joint. Well, the doctor was ready to scope her hip. He was going to repair the labrum. And they wanted to get another opinion because insurance was worried about it a little bit. And so I went in there and examined her and pushed on her, and I could reproduce her pain over the groin region by pushing. So she had a lot of soft tissue pain. It had to be. I can't push on the labrum that deep. I'm pushing on the muscle and the tendon. So we got her to a good hands-on manual therapist who got in there and worked the soft tissue and stretched out the tightness, worked out the myofascial irritation with myofascial release and soft tissue mobilization, and then strengthened it. And darned if that lady didn't come back pain-free and saved her a hip surgery. So the doctor had not examined her enough. He went by the MRI picture, and my God, y'all may have a labral tear and not even know about it. There are many labral tears that are asymptomatic, shoulder and hip. Meniscal tear, same thing. So you got to do the exam. You got to do the history. You got to get good physical therapy. And then one last one, I'll shut up. I had a lady the other day, a 16-year-old lady that was not work comp. She was a high school student, a dancer. So she'd had an MRI, and she was having back pain, maybe a little pain down the leg, but mainly back pain. Somebody got an MRI, and lo and behold, she had this rather significant degenerative disease for a young person, which you don't see that much, 16 years old. She went to a surgeon. Fortunately, the surgeon was a good surgeon, and he said, no, I don't see it enough here to operate. So he sent her to me, and I tried. She looked like she had facet pain, the facet joint, the hinge joint in the spine. She had pain on extension, no pain bending forward. So I started out with a basic myofascial therapist here in Lebanon because she had a lot of soft tissue stuff. They just couldn't do anything with her. It got no better. Then I tried a medial nerve branch block, which was appropriate by the guidelines to see if it was facet pain. No good. Then I sent her to the guru, I call him. There's this one therapist that I use in the area that's doctorate level trained, who is the ultimate and actually mobilizes the spine, somewhat manipulates. He's not a chiropractor. He's a doctorate PhD therapist. And that guy has fixed her. She had 2 years of pain, and now she is fixed. She's back dancing again and doing great. If she had gone to a pain clinic, the wrong hands, they would have started her on narcotics for the rest of her life. So that's a beautiful example of alternative treatment, which is not drugs. It's good manual therapy. And the basic therapy hadn't worked. Insurance companies would say, no more. She failed therapy. Well, this one fortunately gave her the extra chance, and I sent her to the super-duper specialist, and she drove an hour to see him. But I think she'd say, yep, it was worth it. And in 10 visits, he has fixed her after 2 years of pain. So those are the kinds of stories that can happen. And Lord, I'm going to pick the good ones, right? I'm not telling you the bad ones. But there are a lot of good ones out there. So it can happen, but you got to pick your cases. You got to rule out the psychosocial stuff. You got to rule out the drug-induced stuff and then get to the core of the matter. But it's beautiful when you see that. But the doctors, really, I'm not doing a whole lot here. I'm just using common sense and a good history and physical examination, trying to figure out a pain generator. And a lot of my success has been, I know which physical therapist need to see a particular patient. They do the trick. And I take the credit. Not really. I'll brag on the therapist too. But I'm a gatekeeper. That's what I do in work comp. But part of my job is to try to wean them off the drugs and educate them and steer them into the right hands of other specialists, alternatively, like we talked about.
Why aren't all physicians as good as you? I mean, like Greg and I are you're very near and dear to Greg in my heart, but I mean that in all sincerity. So like the physicians, for example, that my mom is treated with, like, why aren't they pushing the educate, counsel, preach, and provide feelings of hope? Like, you guys all take the same code of ethics. So And I guess you could also throw that back on us and say, well, why aren't all insurance carriers like you and Greg? Okay, I agree with that too. But because it's not the easiest road. I mean, that I guess is probably how I would answer that. But what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it is the overhead, the expenses in an office now are just so tough. And, you know, staff and COVID has been so hard. So there's so much stress and trying to meet the payments of the office and all of this stuff. So I think some doctors are just upset with getting in X number of patients a day to cover the overhead. And some of them honestly are greedy. We all have people who are greedy. But, you know, you can't spend the time that I'm talking about very easily and make it work. And I can do it because I've been around 25 years and, you know, I don't worry about all of those stuff like I would if I were younger, I guess. But I think it comes down to what's inside of you. Why you want to be a doctor? Do you really want to help people or not? Having sense enough to say we were wrong, and Lord, I was wrong. And if I used to write OxyContin and Duragesic too, because they take me out and feed me a big steak at a restaurant and wine and dine me and convince me, the drug reps, that this is the best thing it ever was. You know the stories from the past on all that. But you've got to readjust and say I was wrong. I think one thing's helped me is education. I go to a lot of conferences. And, you know, I spend my own money, but I enjoy going to different conferences and learning this stuff. And the national gurus, they don't really see patients. They're the ones that do the research and teach. But I learn that from them and take it back into the office. So I don't think enough doctors are willing to put in those extra hours of studying after you're in practice to learn the new stuff that now is coming out. All of this stuff is newer stuff. You know, even more comp used to not approve any of this stuff, but now they are. So I think
it's Greg a combination of time and effort. We just decided to take on the industry and make good stuff happen. So hopefully everyone else follows with us.
Well, you guys, that's the insurance companies that approve this. And that's where, you know, case managers are key coming to the office. They have relationships with the doctors. They understand which doctors are staying on top of stuff. And then supporting the doctor without sending everything to utilization review, where some doctor in Timbuktu is going to deny and have no clue because they've not seen the patient. But then it's back on the doctor to document and fight for the patient, and nobody's doing that. So in Tennessee, if we have a UR denial, we can appeal it to the Bureau. And, you know, I stop and write a paragraph, dictate a paragraph on why I'm recommending this X amount of therapy on top of what's been done in the past. Why I got this guru on this one girl, works you to be work comp. Why she needed more than the guidelines said. But God, that takes time. I've got to dictate that. I've got to pay somebody to transcribe it. We've got to send records with it. You see, most doctors don't want to go through that full crap. But isn't that the right way to do it? And fortunately in Tennessee, we have the ability to appeal a denial to a doctor, the medical director, who will look at what I've said and most of the time can argue with it and agree. But it takes a lot of time and effort, and it's stressful. We're all stressed out. This COVID has been rough. It really has worn all of us down.
So I've got another question with that. So one, I think that we've got to relook at just all the red tape that exists in workers' compensation. It's absolutely crazy, and it's unbelievable the amount of loopholes that have to be gone through to get to where we need to go. But then I also want to ask, so you said you're bringing up COVID, which we've all been a part of. How has telemedicine either helped or hurt? Because I'm going to say my ignorance on here, but if you are treating these type of patients, my guess is that they're going to want to be actually physically seen. So then how on earth have you navigated that in addition to all the mental health, all the psychosocial amplification of the increased loneliness, lack of social circles, or maybe too much family time, depending on what their structure looks like? I mean, you add in all of those variables and it is just a concoction for complete awry. So how have you navigated that with your patients?
Yeah, I think the new evaluations, I don't know how you do it. They're teaching us now ways that we can do the visual, you know, range of motion testing. I had a IME the other day in Indiana that we did a Zoom deal, and they had set her up with a physical therapist to do the exam at my direction. So I could do the history and get all the nuts and bolts on the history on the phone easily. But then she met with a therapist, and video-wise, I told the therapist what I wanted them to do, and then they'd give me feedback if I couldn't see it. So that's pretty neat. But new patients, I don't know how in the world, you know, I do some personal injury, and they were trying to get me to see these new personal injury patients and these car wreck patients and these car wrecks, and I quit doing it. I couldn't do it. I really examined somebody. But on a new patient, it's very hard to do it visually. Now, these chronic pain patients, they love telemedicine. And initially, we couldn't get many in here at all because of the regulations and all of this time spent scrubbing chairs down and all this checking temperatures and all this stuff. So initially, we did a lot of telemedicine. Now I'm about 30% telemedicine, 70% in the office, and gradually trying to get them more and more in the office. But the chronic pain patients who are stable love it. I see so many patients that are an hour, 2 hours away, so they don't like driving anyway. So many people are scared to death of COVID. I've got people that come in here wearing gloves. I had one the other day with a backpack who had a shoe cleaner. Every time she walked more than 10 feet, she'd squirt the bottom of her shoe because she was convinced she had COVID on her shoes. I mean, we see it all. So those kinds of folks are scared to death still to come to the office. So they love telehealth. The problem, too, is drug screens. I cannot write these narcotics without checking drug screens occasionally. So that was a bear. But now we're able to do some telehealth, and then other times get them in, depending on their risk, how many drug screens a year I need. The problem with that is when they come in, instead of a telehealth, they know what they're coming in for. So they know they go after, so it's not really random, but that's the best we can do. But a true addict will take it no matter what, or not take it or divert it, and they can't help themselves, and you'll catch them, even though they know they're probably going to get a drug screen. You see what happens with that? So it's hard, but I think telehealth is the future. I read more and more about how it's going to be the future. I don't like it. I like to talk to people face-to-face. I like to examine them. I like to have a rapport with them. I have a gut feel in person, whether they're going into crisis or not, and I just can't do that on a Zoom. I like these presentations. This is better than not doing one, but I like to be in front of a live audience and feel the vibration and get feedback. So I'm just not a big telehealth guy or Zoom guy. I love doing this with you guys today. I've got more fired up over this one than I've done others I've done. But, you know, I like being in person. And I think some patients want that, but a lot say, I don't want to come. I'm scared to come. I drive too far. So, but it is the future. We're going to have to do it on some. But my intent is to probably do 90% inpatient, 10% telehealth. I've got, you know, a cancer patient that's 90 that doesn't need to be coming into an office. Then, Lord, yes, do telehealth. But it's not easy. It's not easy at all. I have my nurse practitioners that help me. I'm not a computer guy. You saw what we went through before we started here. I don't know what I'm doing. So they do the telehealth on these follow-ups. And then I like to see the patients in person. If we've done six straight telehealths, I make them come in here because I think I need to eyeball them myself every so often. But I think it's the future. We're going to do a lot of it. But I guess if it gets too much, I'll just retire and say I'm out of here because I don't like it too much, to be honest with you.
Well, Dr. Hazelwood, we truly appreciate you coming on this podcast with us. I really, you know, I think I've heard you speak a number of times over the years, and every time it makes me want to be better and do better at what we do. And Claire and I, when we put together this idea of a podcast, that's what we were looking for, is people who are trying to change for the good. And we really believe that if you do right and you treat people right, good things happen, and surprise, it ends up costing less too. So in the long
absolutely.
Run, in the long
yes.
run.
That's so, a crazy thought.
Well, yeah, it really is. So I just appreciate you coming on with us today. And if you're in the Tennessee area, you know, he's always an option. So
yeah.
Put that out there.
No,
very good at what he does.
Well, and, I just feel like I preach the same sermon over and over, but I don't think it hurts to hear it more than one time.
No, I don't think so.
It's the right way to do it.
Well, we appreciate
you. I appreciate you guys asking me. It's always, I enjoy, as you can see, I enjoy bloviating, but I love getting the message out there. But you guys do great, and I appreciate you understanding where I'm coming from and supporting it, because I think we all are truly trying to help the patient in the long run. What we talked about today does less harm, bottom line.
Excellent. Well, thanks again. We appreciate you joining us.
All right.
That wraps up our podcast today. We want to thank Cameron Runyon for his most excellent music. If you need more music in your life, please reach out to him in our show notes.
And if you would like to drop us a rating on iTunes, please go ahead and drop us a rating. These episodes are dropping every other Monday. So stay tuned and we will continue to educate this fabulous workers' compensation community on all things that make a difference in our world moving forward. Thank you.